radio station. If you like what you're listening to,
it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. Hi, everybody. I really give a shit. I'm thinking about you, and I'm concerned. I care. I want to know what's going on with you. We are really lucky. We have this really amazing artist in the studio today, Matthew Weinstein, and we're going to get to him in a minute. There was something I was going to say, which is that, there was something I was going to tell you guys, and I was gotten this conversation with Matthew, and now I don't remember it, but I'm going to come back to it. So let's just say that we are going to have a call-in number. So if you want to call in, it's 718-395-3731. And I'm coming to you at Radio Free Brooklyn, the best station in the entire Western Hemisphere, that is. And so I hope you saw the, my favorite thing is that, speaking of art, is that how Donald Trump has become, like, my favorite performance artist of all time. I just think that, like, what he's accomplished in his mastery of the media is beyond anything anyone could ever imagine. And I'm giving him, like, a shout-out. I'm giving him, like, a perverted shout-out, like, you've accomplished something really amazing, but nothing that you recognize in yourself. There you go, Donald Trump. Screw you. Okay, so let's get down to business. I want to tell you what's going on here. So, Matthew Weinstein. The reason I invited Matthew Weinstein on here, Stein, like my Aunt Henrietta Stein. My mother's name was Ethel Stein. I come from some Steins, from Jewy Steins. So, Matthew, say hi.
Hello.
There, that's Matthew. He's here. So what I was saying to Matthew was that it's really interesting to me, because the reason I thought of inviting him in here is because, or I really wanted to get him in here, really, not thought of, was that I think that a lot of the stuff that I noticed him talking about on Facebook, he has a real presence, because he has a really, like, balanced and yet very insightful, and I'll say intelligent, a viewpoint that I really, really respect about the art world and the politics of being an artist and all that stuff. And so when I did research on him, knowing he was going to be on the show, and I didn't want to sound like a fucking idiot that I just invited him on here and I didn't really give a shit, I actually read a lot of – I tried to read as much about him as I could in the time I had, whatever. I'm writing a book on you, Matthew.
Okay.
So anyway, I read a lot about him, and I looked at a lot of his work. And I got to tell you, folks, if you're not familiar with Matthew Weinstein's work, it's fucking, like, I am blown away by the complexity, the magnitude, the beauty, the polish, the thinking. It's like really fucking complex shit, right, Matthew?
I try to make it simple, but I fail at that.
Okay, so it's really he fails at that. That's so self-deprecating. I think that's really sweet. I love that about you. I like you, Matthew. I just decided I like you. We just met, but now I really do like you. So the thing is that it just really surprised me, because, I had no idea, and I think it's actually a credit to Matthew that he's actually humble about all that stuff, and that it seems like he puts it in a different category, that he isn't – I think he's got integrity and focus on his work, and that's separate from his art world, politics, business side. Is that true, Matthew?
Yeah, that's the constant discipline.
It's a discipline.
Yeah.
See, that's why he's a good example to have in here to discuss – the art world and being an artist, which was really my intent. But after going through all this stuff, I just want to tell you, this is what I want to try to explain. His work is so complicated and so deep and so multifaceted that I can't possibly explain it. And if I try to describe his work with him, it's just going to take up the whole time. And frankly, it's going to be fucking boring. It's just going to be boring because we're going to be talking about stuff that you really need to see. Right, Matthew? Did I alienate you when I said that?
No. There's a website, so, you know.
But I just so you get an idea, okay, here's some quotes from the bios that I read. Okay, Weinstein's diverse background includes theater, acting, film, screenwriting, design, and painting. Weinstein works exclusively in 3D animation and transfers the technical and narrative concerns of this medium into the art world. And you studied computer. You have a BA from Columbia.
Yeah, in art history.
In art history.
Yeah.
And you've done some art. You've written criticism.
Yeah. When I was at Columbia, I was writing for Art Forum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing now for Art News Online. Okay. And I wrote a lot of catalog essays. And I've always written a lot.
Mm-hmm. And then you also have a degree in computer animation?
No,
or did you just study
that? I did like a semester when I got interested in it. But then I realized that the money I was spending on the school, I could actually just be spending on computers and people to help me learn the software.
Oh.
So I kind of learned by doing.
That's probably because you were pretty focused on what you wanted to learn. You weren't in the, like, you didn't need to try all the different classes to find out,
right? Yeah, I was older than the people in the program, and exactly, mm-hmm. they needed more guidance than I did.
And also, just to... So you really understand, you really need to go to MatthewWeinstein.com and look at the work. There's some really amazing animation, completely unique stuff I've never seen before. I mean, I kind of want to have like – I want to go to like a screening of your films. Have you had that? Have you had that recently?
There will be an exhibition in October. I don't know the exact
next
date
month?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Of your films?
We're showing – we're installing the film, and I'll be showing a few paintings. But mostly the whole gallery will be devoted to one new film.
See, there you go. My wish just came true. What gallery? Is it Sonneben?
No. Sonneben closed. I left Sonneben.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
Jacob Lewis Gallery on 26th Street.
Awesome. Okay, there you go. Oh, we got to put in a plug,
yeah,
an honest plug without even trying to bullshit pretend. He's also in a lot of important collections, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Rubel Collections. He's shown at the he's a big deal, and you should go look up his work because we that would be a whole show, and we don't have time to concentrate on that. That's okay, Matthew, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So here's one of the things. Here's the two things about you that surprised me that I learned. One of them is that you're dyslexic. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Is dyslexia was that a big factor in your upbringing?
Huge.
And how did they find out you were dyslexic?
Because my mother refused to believe that I was stupid.
Okay. And before we get – I want to go back to that. But before – I want you to understand that Matthew's from a fucking genius family. Matthew, do people know this about you?
About my father and that he was a good scientist and everything. Yeah.
Your father – well, you grew up in New York City, and your father, Bernard Weinstein –
I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in New York City.
Okay. Yeah. Jesus. Okay. Well, we're going to go back into Wikipedia. I've got some work cut out for me here, I can tell. Bernard Weinstein, he headed the Comprehensive Cancer Center at Columbia University – and has been credited with helping create the whole field of molecular
epidemiology.
Yes. And one of his students even won a Nobel Prize, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, so you see what I'm saying? I just want you to understand that Matthew's from like a fucking brilliant family. There's no way, two ways around it. You can't hear you. And we're having a little bit of... Really? Can't hear you? We want to hear Matthew more. Can we hear Matthew better?
Hello? Can you hear me? Yes. Now I can hear myself much better.
Wow. Did you pull it all the way up?
Yep.
All right. Wow. Okay. We're learning. Anyway, okay. So I want to go back. So anyway, I want you to understand that Matthew's from a really intelligent family. They recognize intelligence, blah, 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 blah. So Matthew, go back to let's talk about your the whole thing with dyslexia, because that's really from being from such a smart family and all. Like, what was that? How did that come up? What happened there?
I think I was in fifth grade, mm-hmm. and I just had a teacher that thought that I wasn't, performing for whatever reason. I mean, my biggest fear in life is that I'm actually stupid because, and just like there's like a thing like you're dyslexic is you're actually just stupid, but you're from family that put a lot of money into your education.
Oh,
I think a lot of dyslexics feel that way. Like you never get over the idea that the belief that you might be stupid.
Ah, interesting.
It's like a blow to your confidence that happens, you know, at a certain level. It's sort of like when everyone starts growing and you don't.
Right.
You know, everyone's got boobs, but I don't. Like everyone's learning how to read and I can't.
So what happened? And you have two sisters, older, younger. What's your birth order?
I have two older sisters.
Ah, so that must have been like you're also being the youngest. So you're a little bit behind just by like, you know, they're bigger and they can ride bike better or something.
Yeah.
It's just natural too.
They were good at school and everything.
Yeah. So what happened? What were you not good at school?
No, not good at school at all.
Up until fifth grade?
I mean, I was never really – I got good at school in college. I was never great at school because I wasn't good at a lot of – college, you can go and just do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I still can't do – I still have problems with left and right. I don't know how to read a train schedule. I don't really know how to read a map. Like all sorts of things that just – if someone asks me what time it is, I panic because I don't know exactly how to do that every time I'm asked to do it. So you're left with all these like residual things.
Right, because when you were growing up, you didn't think you were that smart.
Yeah.
And everybody accepted that you weren't that smart.
Yeah, that you just sort of move, you know, that you kind of move slowly to the back of the classroom and that's where you're mm-hmm. just where you're going to end up.
Mm-hmm. Were you in like probably a nice private school in
yeah.
New York, I'm guessing?
Not in New Jersey, yeah.
New Jersey, but with yeah. nice kids. I mean, it was the standards were pretty high too.
Yeah, very high. Yeah. Everybody yeah. was, you know. Yeah. I had parents that were putting a lot of energy into them. So that's also why I was lucky because I had a good teacher that noticed that there was something wrong.
Right. So what happened then? How did your life change?
I got really interested in art and reading and anything that was – how do I put this? Things that you can pull out of yourself, mm-hmm. Things that don't have standards attached to them were really attractive to me. You know, like the thing about art that was always interesting to me was the fact that there's no final answer to it, which means
right.
that you just have this infinite field of exploration and then you make your own rigorous boundaries, you know, which happens
right.
over the path of one discovering what they want to make with art. But I thought I was going to be a writer. I got interested in theater, directing. Art kind of came later a little bit
mm-hmm.
for me.
Well, I'm curious about the writing and reading because my understanding, and I could be very wrong, but that dyslexics, and I think I might even have a little bit myself, is like you see things backwards or is that just too literal?
Well, no. I mean, there's different forms. For me, it was yeah. that it was more of a kind of what I read and what was going into my head, which just wasn't working. I guess there'd be a diagnosis for it now, like ADD or whatever. This was before diagnosis culture happened,
right,
you know. So I was just
right.
so I just went in for like I just had special help with reading and all that kind of stuff.
Right. And so did that change the course of your school?
Oh
life?
Yeah. It did.
And you became more confident, or there was always it's always in the background. I guess.
Well,
it.
What teenager is confident? But I mean, you know, I was mm-hmm. never popular or anything. I mean, I had my people, but it was
right.
So I can't say I was confident, but I definitely became very confident about the fact that if there was a question about anything that was either philosophy or art or whatever
thinking,
I could hold my own extremely
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
So you know,
and it seems to me that you have a real facility for drawing. Is that true?
No, I don't.
Huh? How do you manage to make things so perfect?
I have people that work for me who are better doing it than I am. I initiate projects and then I have this. I don't know what it is, but I have this idea that things have to be in a certain level of perfection, kind of unreality. And when I can't get there, I hire people that
no.
can get the work there.
So there must have been a way, like there must have been a point where how did you even get started then if you can't do it? I mean, believe me, I study illustration and I'm frustrated with my ability to draw. Like how would you even communicate or get to – how did you even get to hire – like how did you work that out?
Well, I kind of went from art history to just experimenting. I used to work for some artists to make money, and I realized that all the painters I worked for, I mean, none of them could draw, and none of them were interested in drawing. I mean, drawing was never part of the art school curriculum. So in a sense, it wasn't until I worked for artists to make money that I realized, oh, right, I don't – I mean – if I wanted to make figurative paintings, it would be a different issue, but I had no interest in doing it. So in a sense, it was just for me like – it was like art history or thought or philosophy.
Oh, so you managed to see – because I'm from the school of like I could draw a bit and stuff like that, and art was what I was interested in. But I was always competing with the other kids who could draw. It was all based on drawing like musical theaters based – you know, theater in high school or school. Middle school is based on how well you can sing. It felt like that, but you came from a completely different, pretty unique angle, I think.
Well, it's why words like talent and creativity like completely freak me out, because I don't know what those things are. And most really good artists I know are not talented and aren't that creative.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I think the creativity... I think being an artist is anti-creative in that you start out, and yes, a lot of artists are these kind of children that people would call creative, and it really is like reining it in. So in a sense, you're taking your creativity and you're sort of funneling it into something. And for me, creativity, it has a sort of childish connotation of like a box of yarn and some scissors. Mm-hmm, and, you know, and really like if you look at a minimal painter, you know, who makes it monochromes. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you really call that creativity? It's something very, very different. It's something more interesting than creativity. It's something about saying, here's this whole field of creativity, and I'm going to narrow that field down to this tiny little thing, to this rectangle. Mm-hmm. So you shrink the whole spectrum of it.
Right.
So in a way, it's this kind of anti-creativity, and that's also the kind of art I tend to get interested in, is the art that sort of bypasses this sort of multiple impulse of being highly creative and works through strategies of exclusion.
Right. So from what I read, just to explain it in a simple way, is like it seems like you're really drawn to things that are really abstract, like books that don't necessarily have plots and things like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm deeply influenced by writers like Rob Grier. Mm-hmm. I still like old creaky metaphysics. I like all those things. And also because one of the things about being whatever I was, dyslexic or ADD, I don't know what the hell it is, but is that I can't follow things very well. Or I get like, it's like if I stop and ask someone directions, mid-explanation, I'm so bored.
Oh, yeah.
That I just want them to go away. And so, like, I smile, and then I walk off in the wrong direction because I haven't listened to a thing they're saying, you know? And it's so I have a hard time.
That's a relief. I feel like I'm like that. That's a relief. So how do you even handle going to art openings? That's like a million people talking about directions.
Well, no, but that's more – I mean, I love socializing. I really do like being around – I love being around artists and friends. So – but no, it's just more like, when a movie starts, I get very panicked. Like, I'm like, God, I don't know who these people are and what are they doing, and they're getting in a car and where are they going, and I can't enjoy myself. So when I start out on an abstract film or novel or some book about metaphysics, I'm like, okay, this is home turf. I don't have to worry about this stuff. All I have to do is involve myself with whatever this is.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I kind of get like that when I like, you know, like I mean, you know, what is that show? Like, let's talk about House of Cards. Like, I like it, but I feel like my husband is always coaching me through it as far as, like, the plot points and, like, what happened the last week and last month. Is that what you're talking about, like, forgetting all the plot points?
Game of Thrones, I watch it while I return emails because I've lost the thread of it. I like it because it looks crazy, but, like, I lost the thread of it, like, so many seasons ago. I have no idea where they're going. Who are these people? Why is it winter?
Yeah, you know? And then I feel – my psychology is such that I blame it on myself and I say I can't remember.
Yeah, well, that's part of it too. I mean, part of me, you know, I think that basically there's a laziness that comes with that comes along with it. I feel sometimes that if I had just worked harder
you feel the same way. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't, and I think partially it's true because I think that we all could work harder. But, you know, you have to kind of split the difference in these things. If you just beat yourself up, you're not going to get anywhere. But if you give yourself an out, an ultimate out, you're also not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, how important is it to really know the entire details of all the plot of Game of Thrones or House of Cards or whatever show you watch, really? So I want to start asking – I want to go back to your dad because that sounds so interesting to me. Like, what was it like having – like, what were your parents like? What was that like? What was your – being in your family like?
My father was extremely hardworking, very kind, and was a great role model in terms of devoting yourself, you know, in a very focused way to something mm-hmm. very abstract and something that was very sort of on the margins of culture. And even when he started, cancer was on the margins of medicine. I mean, it was a very small field when he began doing cancer mm-hmm. research. So mm-hmm. it was, you know, I didn't process this when I was younger, but as
right.
I got older, it was revealed to me as I learned about
right.
him that, you know, he was doing something that was not necessarily going to be important, and it ended up being important.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my mother painted, made prints.
So she was an artist.
Yeah. And my sisters, I know we all, you know, I was interested in art. I used to go mm-hmm. to galleries with my mother in Soho.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go to Castelli and Sonnenbend and mm-hmm. all these places. So, you know, it was, and they had a lot of friends that were artists. It was diverse Judaism, I guess. You know.
Mm-hmm. So your mother was really interested. She brought a lot of art into the house.
Oh yeah, and all the friends that they had who were artists. Were, came from her. And
right.
And my father's scientist friends were more. He had his scientist friends, but that was more. That wasn't necessarily part of the family. That was more his professional thing, and
right.
he would travel all over doing conferences.
Right.
So he had a whole social life, which we didn't really participate in that often.
Right. I imagine, like, it seems like, did your father, did he make a lot of money? I mean, was he that kind of successful, or was
no.
it more, I mean, like, when you read what he does, you know, you picture him running, you know, whatever, being, you know, being really successful, but now that I'm talking to you, it sounds like he might have been sort of more struggling.
Well, he didn't struggle. He had a really well-paid job at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
As he got older and biotech started happening, he never worked in the industry. He was really pure science, but he would be invited to consult
mm-hmm.
at biotech companies. So, you know, there was a greater degree of comfort as they got older and as his fields became more popular.
And also, but
we were fine. There was never any
yeah.
We never had a money complaint, and you know.
And I'm not really just talking about the money. I'm talking about the respect and all that. So did he gain stature? Did he gain was it a surprising amount of stature? I mean,
well, you know, it's stature that
respect. He invented, or he worked on a lot of really important things. There's no way around it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But you know, it's like it's like this micro world
mm-hmm.
science. You know,
right.
like no one. I couldn't. He's written so many papers. I don't know how many times I picked them up when I was younger and tried to read them. It's like I could more easily read Chinese. There's no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's no human language in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, it is this very cut off micro world. And I know that when I'd see his colleagues, I saw him mixing in a way which, in the end, I think as an artist, I've ended up imitating.
What does that mean? That's interesting.
That, you know, I think that artists, we tend to rely mostly on the respect of other artists.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of what how we breathe and
mm-hmm.
how we, you know, very few artists are going to go to a party that has nothing to do with art, and they're like, "Oh, you're Matthew Weinstein." You know what I mean? Like, there's
right.
you know what I mean? Very, very few artists do that, and even
right.
artists who in the art world are huge names in many circumstances, no one would know who the hell they
Absolutely.
Are. So that was what science was like, and I think, you know, there's a comfort in being with your colleagues because they know who you are, they know where you're coming from, they respect you. So it
right,
and I think that that's how I've ended up imitating. Also, his laboratory I always liked, and I think my studio is kind of like that because, you know, I have people working for me. We pursue different projects and sort of different workstations and different areas, and it always feels like we're in a continual state of experimentation.
That's really interesting. So did your dad, were you exposed to your dad's laboratory? Was it at home? Did you go to his office?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. Yeah, we went a lot.
So you were actually at his office quite a bit.
Yeah. I used to play with RNA and DNA models when I was a kid and hang out with the secretary and then when we were teenagers we'd go there and we'd have jobs Xeroxing and collating papers.
I see.
And then the scientists that worked for him, a lot of them were family friends, the sort of lifers were family friends.
So there's a community in a certain way.
Absolutely.
Which is sort of interesting because when you think of doctors, or even people working in the medical field, which he is, you think of you don't think of a community like an art community, but this is it's interesting to
science,
hear about that.
Science community is an art community. There's absolutely no difference. And there's the same amount of competition in that there's very little research money and they're all going for the same grants. But the only option in any of these communities is to show up and be nice because ultimately this is your tribe.
Yeah, right.
And you don't fuck with your tribe.
Right, right. I had this impression that before you walked in, I had this impression that maybe your father was a workaholic and not around a lot.
Well, he wasn't around a lot, but he wasn't around a lot. It wasn't in a negative way because he would take us, each of us, to Europe to a conference, or he'd spend a lot of time with us in the summer. He was around in that he was a presence and he was interested in us. He's a man of a certain generation. So fundamentally, the most important thing for him in terms of time was his work. But he was
it sounds like he had a pretty he was a pretty unusual he was more balanced than I would have expected. He really sounds that way.
No, he was around and he was good.
That's really awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone who has a father from that generation has a sense that their father was there all the time. I mean, the point of men was to work.
Well, my father, I'll just tell you, my father was there all the time, every evening at after six, and he wasn't there ever.
Yeah, yeah.
He was the most, so it's really quality of time.
Absolutely.
My father was super, super distant. So what you're talking about is a guy who really cared and connected.
Yeah.
And what about your mother? Did they have a good relationship?
Yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm.
They did.
So it sounds like a pretty nice, nice healthy background.
Yeah, I mean, every family.
It wasn't perfect.
Every family lost their shit in the 70s. Mm-hmm. It was a collective, mind fuck. You know what I mean?
I know.
And also, you have a house with a bunch of teenagers in the 70s and the whole thing. And, of course, there was high drama moments. But, I know people who from such crappy families that I've never. One thing I've never complained about is my family.
No, it sounds like a really good family to grow up in, with a lot of different aspects to be enriched by and nurtured by. Yeah, and you appreciate it too, I think.
Yeah. Well, I didn't when I was an obnoxious teenager, but in my adult life, once my brain kind of grew to fit my skull, yeah, I realized, and especially meeting other people out in the world who were telling me stories of their families that were so sad or horrifying or situations of such deprivation that I realized that really, for me to complain would be absolutely ridiculous.
So let's see. I just want to do a station ID because we're at about the half an hour and remind people that this is Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, coming to you from Radio Free Brooklyn. And listen in. This is a really good conversation. We're learning so much about Matthew's work. And now we're gonna start talking about a little more about him personally and the art world. So there were a few things. I just wanted to ask you a few questions. So we didn't really talk about you. So I have the worst gaydar. Are you gay or straight?
Gay.
And do you have a relationship? Have you had a lot of relationships?
I've been with the same person, David, for 16 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So was that a big deal coming out to your family and all that stuff? How was that?
It was a little bumpy. And then...
Were they surprised?
my father wasn't. My mother was. You know, it was a little bumpy because everything was a little bumpy. And I think that, I don't know, you know, what am I trying to say? I think that everyone did their best.
Right, right. But what do you mean by, I mean?
Because people didn't understand gay people back then. You know, they didn't know any.
So what year would that have been, like 80s, 80s, sometime in the mid 80s when you spoke to your parents?
Yeah,
about
it was also like the height of the AIDS crisis.
Oh my God, right.
So, you know, the whole thing was, thing was very fraught. So
we don't blame them at all.
Yeah.
I'm only curious
and
as
also,
the effect on you.
And they had no idea that a gay person could even be in a relationship.
Oh, right, right, right.
You know what I mean? Like all this stuff is such new information to people.
Right.
Like still when I say like I've been with David for 16 years with straight people, they're always like, "Wow." And
still?
I'm like, "Why are you saying wow?"
Still people are like that?
Yeah, totally. Wow.
Wow.
And like,
well, I'll tell you, you know, when I moved to New York in 1978 after college, and I have to say I was surprised at how many gay people there were, openly gay people. I mean, not that I'm certainly not a narrow-minded person, and I wasn't being narrow-minded. I was just surprised how prevalent it was and that I had no – this is going on, and I had no idea. This is such a – you know, this is so common, and I didn't know. I felt so sheltered.
Yeah, and I think they realized how common it was and that, mm-hmm. you know, they didn't – I mean, there's a lot of 50s ideology to let go of for them. In the 70s – I keep talking about the 70s, I think was such a rift for people.
Oh,
and for people from with a 50s mentality, I think it was a very violent rift because basically all the things that were supposed to complete their lives, they were informed that these things no longer matter.
It was a culture – I call it a cultural revolution really. Did you feel bad? Did you feel bad about like I wonder, you know, you are protective of your parents, and I wonder if it was hard for you, or if you feel like, I'm just trying to be empathetic, I think, but I'm getting a sense that like it might be hard that you might feel bad in some way that you brought that into their lives. I mean, not that you feel guilty or that it's wrong, but just like that, it was tough for you, but it was tough for them.
Well, you know, nobody wants to be gay. It just is who you are. I mean, it's not like a straight person is going to be like, God, I wish I was gay. You know what I mean? And no parent sits around dreaming about their children being gay.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, of course, the thing that helps almost everyone when they come out, and I've always told parents, like friends whose kids are deciding they're gay and now all their daughters want to be men and everything. I always say that, you know, you don't have to worry about them too much because the one thing about people who are coming out is often that you're so shielded by your own narcissism. I mean, I trampled on the feelings of so many people because I was only concerned with myself. And and that's a protective mechanism. Like I couldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking, oh, gee, this is making my mother nervous or my father doesn't understand or my father's concerned. I was just furious that the world didn't all of a sudden say, wow, you're amazing. You know,
right.
And most people I know, like for me, like in terms of gay men, there is nothing more narcissistic than a gay man coming out because you have all the entitlement of maleness.
Right.
And then above that, you have the entitlement of demanding even more from the world. So you're basically just this, you know, raging source of narcissism. So, you know, I always say like, you know, unless you have a family that's punishing you deeply.
Right.
That's a whole other category. But if you're just sort of in a sort of normal coming out awkwardness.
Right. Hey, who wants to talk?
You're fine. You know?
Yeah, what teenager wants to talk about their sexuality and on any level?
With
no
their parents.
Yeah, exactly. No one wants to talk about that.
It's embarrassing.
But it sounds like you have a pretty – you sound like – well, you know, you sound like you're – you know, you've got a pretty balanced thing going. I think that maybe you overcoming your dyslexia gave you a certain perspective and strength and ability to like reframe things and just good survival skills, man.
Well, you know, if you're continually humiliated as a teenager, I think you end up in a really good place sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first it was dyslexia, then I had twitches, and then I had the, you know, repetitive motion things, and then the gay, and I was like, what the fuck more is going to pop out of me that's embarrassing
so
and humiliating?
So what happened? Did you get rid of the motion things and all that?
Sometimes I rock back and forth at night, David informs me, and I still blink a lot. I have sort of facial twitches. When I get nervous, people can tell because I start doing strange things.
But it's just like something you don't think about a lot. That was just more awkward when you were a teenager.
Well, I was teased and stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So
of course you were.
Yeah. But they went away as I got older and as I got more comfortable with myself and God knows what all that stuff was. But this wasn't, you know, if I'd have had all that stuff now, I'd be like so on the spectrum or whatever parents talk about now.
Yeah.
But I mean, in my generation, you just, I don't know, it's like there's Matthew, he twitches, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's just like.
So let's talk about the art world. What I'm really interested in is your perspective on like what's like, I want to know like what you think is changing. I get a feeling like things like, you know, you were saying like you're saying on Facebook, like the role of the artist, I think, is changing. What's your take on how things are if you're an artist now?
Well, the things that, I mean, there are certain things which don't change. You know, the things that I find don't change is artists' interest in each other, artists' interest in art, the artists' support of each other. I've always found kind of incredible. It really, really does exist. It's a highly competitive field, but it's really tribal. Like you really sense that if you know, unless you have the privilege of existing in some, you know, off-world colony outside the art world, if you're dependent on it for, you know, your support and your career, you kind of know that if you just don't fuck around with people, and you should help people if you like their work.
Right. And and people connect through their work. Like if you wind up having friends whose work you admire because it's, you just get each other.
Yeah.
And it's a cool thing, and it's a very special sort of connection, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think for artist friends, the first point of contact is often the studio visit, you know, which I love that. Like when someone says to me, you know, lately a lot of people have been saying, you know, can I come by your studio? I want to see what you're doing, because I think more people are starting to notice what I'm doing, especially artists, because I was so early with the animation and, you know, and I find that that's a very touching and important point of contact for me. It means more than a lot of other kinds of gestures.
Yeah, like let's
talk about
get drunk or something.
Yeah. No, exactly. Just it means a lot that they're gonna take the time out of their day to come see what I do.
That's nice to hear that, you know, that you appreciate the studio visits. A lot of times, because you're a successful artist, a lot of times a lot of artists don't always realize how appreciated that is.
Also, what, you know, a studio visit is like, it's not like, it's a day, you know? I mean, even if you stop by, I mean, it was easier when we all had studios in Chelsea. But now, you know, to get to the Brooklyn and to get to the apartment, it's like it actually, you know, and then you end up yakking for like 3 hours. So it ends up being a day of your life spent making contact with someone else, which I think is really cool. And I find it really flattering that someone wants to come do that.
Wow, that is that is really nice to hear. So, like, what do you think about, like, so this is my sense. My sense is everything's going, the gallery system is breaking down and things are going to like art fairs and online. What's your take on that?
I think it is happening, and it's not a happy thing, because I really like art galleries, and I also feel that part of the job description of artists, if it can be called such a thing, is not just making the work, but in a sense, every year or 2 years or whatever, you have a show, and part of your job is to install that show with your dealer to create an immersive environment, and that's being taken away.
Right.
And I find that when work goes to art fairs, we're kind of being treated like children. Like, just make your stuff, and we're going to, like,
right,
don't worry about it. We're just going to hang it on a wall, and please don't come to our booth, and we'll call you if it sells.
I know. I have to tell you something. I had my first solo show at an art fair in Miami last winter, and I love the people, you know, Schroeder and Romero. They're great ladies. But I was just shocked how, like, little contact you're supposed to have with your own work or your own display. I mean, like, you don't get that, like, you have no sense of like how people are feeling about your work. It's like totally removed. It's like they took your children and kidnapped them.
It's weird. I mean, I don't blame the dealers.
No.
Because this is, they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to do this stuff, and they work their asses off.
They do.
But they hate it. The dealers aren't happy. They don't want to do this. They want to be in their galleries.
You're right.
You know what I mean? But
no.
they have to, or they can't stay alive, because that's the only way.
It's really hard on them.
It's really hard.
It's less fun for everybody, and it's really hard on them. No question about it. But that's how things are going, right?
Yeah, and the art fair has also kind of created this sort of art fair art thing, which tends to be easily legible work that is almost always painting. You never see video or technology-based art or anything in an art fair, very, very rarely. They always put the video in some stupid thing like a black box screening room. And like, who the hell is going to go in there during an art fair?
Yeah, let me just take an hour out of my day. Right.
Right. So I don't even – I mean, one thing about my videos is that I don't
expect people to watch them like in a linear way.
Yeah, I don't do screenings. I do screenings for art students, but I won't do screenings or film festivals, any kind of screening. I don't think that there's something when I write these things and do them, I want them to be like that moment where you're reading but you're thinking about something else.
I mean, I find that incredibly generous. You know, very generous and very unusual.
Well, I just find it embarrassing to sit there. Like, I did a screening at a museum because I had an exhibition, and they asked me to do a lecture, so I did a screening. And I was just sitting there squirming because I just was – all I could – you know, I could – every time – it was like a fairly conservative city. And it was a thing with a lot of, you know, just like off-color stuff. And every time I was just like – I got no joy out of it. And it – so I just felt like, you know, the less I have to do that, the better. Also, I think they're objects. I think they're meant to be lived around and not forcing someone to say, okay, you have to sit here for half an hour.
Kind of like the way I see like Empire by Andy Warhol. Like that seems like something that you might have – just going
exactly.
in the background.
And also you can – I mean, for me, they can be on with the sound off in someone's house or whatever. I don't care. I just – I like the fact that they're just something that you see out of the corner of your eye. And if you want to know more, you tune in, you tune out.
You can consume them in any way.
You choose – you choose your relationship to the pieces.
Which is how – like I think I read somewhere you said you could spend like – an hour with a painting, or you could spend 5 minutes with a painting.
Yeah, or as most of us do, what is the 20 seconds? There's some
–
I think that go into – I mean, if I go into a show, if I spend 10 minutes in there and there's five paintings.
That's a lot.
I mean, that's a long time. That means I really like it.
Yeah, that's a lot. So I'm like I'm disappointed. There's a combination of words that begin with the word dis, and like what's happening? Because like there used to be so much great art, and now I do feel like everything is like, you know, getting to be like a very common denominator, just like all the other cultural, you know, just like film and all this other stuff. So what are we gonna do, or how do you find good art, or where do you think there is good art to find?
Well, I mean, truthfully, I'm critical, so I've never liked – I mean
– Oh, so you've never liked anything, so it's easy for you.
I mean, I'm not – just because something's – I don't love something just because it's contemporary art. I've never been a total fanboy for contemporary art. Also, I come from an art history background. So, you know, like I'm not like, oh, wow, it's contemporary. It's in a contemporary gallery. I'm all for it. I judge everything. I go into every situation with enormous skepticism. So I've never felt like there was a moment – I mean, looking back at it, when I was in college and going to the East Village and there was all this really great conceptual art, conceptual photography, it was really lively. And all we can do is hope that there's people who have that kind of energy again. I mean, it's not going to come from me. I've already been – I've already done it. So in a sense, like, you just have to hope. And I know you go to the Lower East Side and you go to Brooklyn and you see small galleries that are – trying, you know?
Yeah, I guess what's happened for me in a way is that the energy of the art, of what I call the art world, my art world or something, and like what, you know, I used to love to go to like Soho and stuff like that. And also because I think you're very directed in the kind of work that you do, and have always been, whereas like I'm, you know, I'm just looking for different ideas that execute all different ways. So for me, I think I get stimulated by a very broad scope of ideas and work. And I think that, you know, I have a harder time finding that to satisfy myself. But at the same time, I still have a bunch of artist friends that I can hang out with. They're not showing in those galleries and the galleries in Chelsea and stuff like that. But doesn't matter, really. I have my people and I have my work.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, it's always been you have to carve your own experience out of this giant mass of stuff. I mean,
right.
There's 50,000 art worlds and they're all orbiting
right.
around each other. And I think there's this myth that they're all orbiting around this one mainstream art world, but it's not actually true.
Right. That's what Rob said.
They're all in their own little bubbles and they all have their own kinds of support systems. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like I go to these – you know, you go to a online looking at art and there's some artist who's – selling paintings for $150,000, you've never heard of them. They don't even look like contemporary art. There's a whole thing going on, and you're like, wow, there's all this other, you know, like you get so puffed up in New York and the art world thinking that you're at the center. And then you have to constantly remind yourself that that's just the wrong way of looking at life and that you have to open your mind saying that there is no center.
Right. And there's also just so many directions that anyone's career or path or interest can go in that it's kind of hard to even find one way to, you know, define them, right?
Yeah, I mean, I struggle like everyone is right now with the focus on money. I mean, it's also this is how I make money. So I can't say I'm against money. I just find that the conversation, like, you know, I was just the other day, I was looking at all these art sites like ArtNet and these things. They always have like collectors' top 10 lists. Mm-hmm. They never have an artist. You know, it's always about what people are buying. And I think a lot of collectors are intelligent, passionate people. But, you know, why are we leaving out the artist voice?
Well, it seems like what's happened is that the prices of art as a investment has definitely, I mean, that's changed a lot, changed the art world a lot, I think, because it is a good, it can be, it's like a fun investment. It's like buying futures.
It's also, it's happening. Mm-hmm. The prices are extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
So it is news. Just like, you know, they didn't used to publish movie grosses.
That was never an issue.
And then they started publishing, I believe it was during the independent film boom in New York, they started publishing like how much Sling Blade made or like the big independent films.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same thing. The filmmakers thought it was really disgusting that all of a sudden you have, you know, and now we take it as a matter of course that there's all – the grosses are always published. So this is just where we are. This is a change that will never – we're never going to go back to a time.
Yeah, no, you know? I mean, we can't go back. I'm one of those people that it's like, you know, nostalgia is for losers. We got to move on. It just seems that, and I have my own ideas, certainly. I think everyone does about what they think good work is, where creativity is, where they get, even though you hate that word, but where you get, you know, where you get your inspiration. It doesn't, you know, it's so broad, but... But it seems also that like critics used to have much more of a role in the way art was valued. Do you think that's true? Do you think that's changed?
Oh yeah, the critical establishment has no real power. I mean, when I first started showing, and I had my first New York Times review, the gallery was packed, and people bought things because of it. That no longer is true. I don't think critics really give a damn whether I don't think critics ever wanted that power because they're not making the money. So
no.
I think the problem for critics is that there's just no – there are no magazines and the online people don't pay very well or at all. So I think that's the problem.
Well, I mean the career of the critic is definitely like not – you know, it was never like – I mean it's always been a tough career and it's certainly not getting any better or any easier for any critic or any writer really in the media. But what seems like it's happening I mean, it seems like the collectors are replacing the critics.
Yeah, it's the age, I mean, the 90s and late 80s was the age of the critic. I think the 70s and 60s were the age of the artists, and I think now we're in the age of the collector. Like, they're having their moment, and it would be nice if we could go back to, you know, at least establishing a more strong artist voice in terms of what happens in the art world. But I think it's also up to artists. I mean, the reason I write, I'm doing this stuff for Art News is because I think it's important that artists actually start writing more.
Right, and I think that's really, I think that's like a great takeaway from this conversation is that artists, because critics can't do it. I mean, that's not what they, you know, artists really have to start taking back that kind of power because they're the only ones who can really get to that. They're the ones making it. They're the ones promoting each other.
Except artists have this – I mean, I always think that artists maybe have a high – I bet that there's a high percentage of youngest children who are artists or children who were once had a moment of extreme cuteness who got a lot for free and then the cuteness went away really quickly and – trying to relive a kind of like infantile moment of glory.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because I think that artists have a tendency to infantilize themselves, and artists are infantilized. Like that's you become an artist, and you're signing up for something where you know collectors always pay the bill, dealers always pay the bill for dinner. You know, you're always in a situation where you're kind of the child. And the person that's working for you or supporting you is the adults. I mean, it's really freaky when you get over 50 and you realize that you have collectors who you're treating like they're your parents because they're taking you out to dinner, but they're 15 years younger than you are.
I could see that because the collectors aren't yeah, they're not in that world. They see you. They want you to be that.
Well, I don't even think they care. I think it's more what we do to ourselves as artists and how we position ourselves is we begin to convince ourselves that if I only had a big dealer, then I'd be great. If I only had this, if I only had that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had that, and you're not on like some fast, easy track for the rest of your life. And so when I think – and then a lot of artists – then you can fall back and say, well, I am doing something to have a voice. I'm making my art. But that's not enough sometimes. Sometimes then you have to do something outside of your work to have a presence. And for me, it's writing. And most artists I know, some aren't good writers. Most artists are pretty good talkers because we talk in our studios to each other, to collector groups, to curators. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time talking. So – you know.
Well, I've made money as an art director. I mean, I haven't really, you know, I have made some money lately, but, you know, art wasn't about making a living for me. It's been like my second career. So it's always been my first career, but now it's actually my career. So the thing is that since I've come from like a background where I'm not really – you know, I mean, I do think that you have to do everything yourself. I come from the place, like, if an artist is complaining that they're not getting in enough shows, it's because they're not making it happen. Like, there's always a place where you can send your work in or you can get something shown if you really want to.
Yeah, you can rent a space, which is what happened in the East Village in the early 80s. These artists rented spaces in the East Village and opened their own galleries. And those artists, many of them became very well-known artists. And it was a really amazing time. And the whole thing only lasted a couple of years. But it was such a powerful moment.
Right.
You know?
Right. And I think a lot of artists nowadays, like I had somebody contact me and say, you know, I really need some representation. Could I, you know, can you help me get some representation? And it's like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Do you think a lot of artists feel that way? That like they need... they deserve help or something?
Well, you know, a lot of people say, you know, art schools aren't preparing artists for the realities of the art world. How do you get a gallery? How do you do that? And I don't believe that you can teach that. I don't think that should even be part of the conversation in art school. I think that if you don't have the brains to go to all the galleries in Chelsea and you're in art school, or go to all the galleries in Lower East Side or start forming attachments to other artists, then you're never going to figure it out.
Right.
No, there is no way to get a gallery. It's not actually a career. You know, it's actually just a sort of organized mess. So, yeah, you throw yourself into the thing and then you either get things or you don't get things. I mean, no one ever promised anyone an art show.
Right. And I think you do have to have a really – You have to have a very self taking care of yourself. You have to be able to make the shit in any career, really.
But art's different. The difference in art is that it's about fluidity. That if you're in art school and you want to be taught how to get a gallery and how to be an artist, then you're probably not an artist.
Right.
Because art is completely fluid. And the things that come out of it are fluid, and you put energy into it, and then all of a sudden you get a call, and you're like, wow, that's weird.
Right,
like something good happens because you've actually been working unconsciously towards something guided by your own passion and interest, you know? But it isn't like, how do you write a resume? I mean, there's nothing, you know what I mean? There's nothing to teach. You can't teach these things. It's like, how do you, an actor, how do you get into a movie? Like, well, you have to be born an actor, and even then you might not get into anything.
I think that a lot of people, I mean, I think that art schools have really changed because like when I was in college, you know, I mean, I studied commercial art, but the idea of studying art was only because you weren't good at something else. Like the idea of studying art wasn't a career. It was just because you couldn't do math or science or something else. I mean, the idea now, it seems like they actually consider art a career that you can go to school for.
Yeah, which I don't think is bad. I mean, I think in a sense, you know, there's a certain power in that. I don't...
Really?
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, because I think, you know, people do criticize the 80s as this watershed moment where the artist became a quote-unquote professional. And I get why that's bad, but I also get why that's good because it means that artists actually are learning how to take what they do seriously and sort of not just wait for, like, the, you know, chance occurrences where something might happen, and that they're more in control. And I think that it's good, you know.
Yeah.
And I think also what you know, you look at how these artists can pull together a graduate show. I mean, it's the they're so together. I mean, I never went to art school.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I never went to art school, but I remember, like, lecturing in art schools, like, a long time ago, and it was just, you know, they would graduate with a complete chaos.
No, I guess you're right. Yes, I see what you mean. To put structure and discipline into being an artist, which wasn't always the case.
No, it wasn't. And I think that, you know, you're also confronting a city that's more and more expensive. I mean, I think in days before, you could actually say, well, I have 20 years to make this work because I have a cheap apartment and I have a job and I can make enough money. And now it's not the case in this city.
Well, I think that also. But what I do think is opening up is that you really don't need to live in New York City anymore. I think with the art fairs and being, you know, selling art online, I think that's really opening things up a lot for people.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, you need so we have 2 minutes. Do you think you can describe in 2 minutes why 3D animation has turned you into a basket case?
Because it ruined everything for me, because it made me look at everything as if it doesn't necessarily need to be real.
How is that bad?
Because it's this completely obsessional space. And if you're an obsessional person and you put yourself in that space, you drive yourself completely crazy trying to navigate and perfect and control that space.
Ah, I see. It's way too unlimited.
It's way too unlimited. So you have this godlike control over gravity and lighting and texture. And then you're wondering, you know, what do I do in here?
Wow, that is frightening. So are you a workaholic?
No.
So do you have enough time with your partner? Is he an artist as well?
He's an architect.
Oh, so
I'm a workaholic, and that all I think about is art and art-related things, and I only read books that feed into my art. But I in my studio from – I know I usually leave by 6 p.m.
Oh, well, and you guys have, like, fun things that you do together.
Yeah.
And does he work a lot as well?
Yeah, he works.
He works more than you do, probably.
Oh, yeah, because he has his own architecture firm. So he works at least 10 to 12 hours a day.
Oh, wow. What a productive couple.
Yeah, we're productive.
That's good. And so we're going to have to wrap this up. But you know what? I want to make this point that Matthew, like, some of the other people we've had on here, creative people, is another great example of somebody who's really balanced and has their shit together, and that's why they're successful, okay? He's not one of those, like, crazy, drug-addled, whiny, unhappy, miserable people. And that's what I want you guys to know. Get your shit together. Anything is possible. It's all up to you. Right, Matthew? Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Sort of.
I really miss being drug addled.
I guess we missed that part.
No.
I read that you said you don't like drugs and that because your work is psychedelic, but coffee is actually too much for you. Dr. Lisa gives a shit.